Welcome to episode 81, hysterectomy. Many of you will never have linked this surgical procedure to pelvic floor physiotherapy before. And if that's the case, I'm glad you're here. I really do think this surgery is downplayed for a few reasons. Most women don't shout from the rooftops when they have a surgery related to such a personal area. Plus, it's hidden. Nobody can see if you've had it. But it's a big deal, physically and emotionally, for some people. The uterus is our main reproductive organ, and surgical removal can signify the end of a chapter. This topic deserves to be covered. My guest today is back for a second time, and for that I'm very grateful. Dr. Kate Collins is a Kelowna-based OBGYN who wonderfully described the sequence of events during a cesarean birth in episode 76 of the podcast, and now she's here to discuss hysterectomy with me. We will talk about why this surgery is being performed less than it was in years past, reasons why it may be the best option for a patient, laparoscopic, vaginal, and open abdominal approaches, reasons why the fallopian tubes and ovaries may be included, what you can expect for length of time in the hospital, pain management and post-op guidance, the benefits of compression after surgery, and I share what we as physiotherapists have to offer patients before and after hysterectomy. We hope you find this episode helpful. I'll be right back with Dr. Kate Collins. Before we get going, I know many of you listeners are also physiotherapists because you have reached out, curious about recommendations for pelvic health courses. So I want to take time to ensure you know about the Cheerful Academy, created by two highly skilled and experienced physiotherapists. Anakin Chadwick and Trish Gibson have teamed up to offer an online training and mentorship platform for physios looking to feel more capable and confident in their practice. Their signature offering is the Pelvic Health Fundamentals course. It's designed for physios who have taken the internal courses, but feel they have some gaps in their knowledge or tend to feel stuck with how to apply what they've learned once they get into the treatment room. The course is designed not to overwhelm you with information, but rather to help you get clear and make your next day in clinic easier. So if you're looking to build your clinical competence and confidence in pelvic health, then this is something I would recommend. The next cohort kicks off in January 2024. Follow the link in the show notes to take advantage of $150 off before December 15th. Hey listeners, have you ever heard of using a compression garment after a pelvic surgery? Did you know that there are other countries where this is much more common practice, that women are being informed about the benefits of compression after surgeries like hysterectomy, prolapse repair, and C-section from the time they leave the hospital and even before? For this reason, I've been liaising with SRC Health, an Australian-based company, to learn how we can start implementing this practice in not only my community of Kelowna, but in North America in general. I'm grateful to have SRC Health as this episode's sponsor, and I want to take time to tell you about their high-quality products. Using a revolutionary fabric created by medical professionals, SRC has designed a line of compression shorts and leggings that are made to support the tummy, back, and pelvis in pregnancy, or help you feel less pain and more confident with movement as you recover after pelvic surgery or birth. To check out their full line, head to their website, www.srchealth.com, and enter the code The Pelvic Floor Project, all capital letters, at checkout for 10% off. Doesn't your body deserve the support at such a time of transition? Okay, Dr. Kate Collins, I'm excited to have you one more time before you head back to work from your maternity leave. I thought I'd kind of corner you or beg you before you get really busy, because I know that you all have such a busy job and a busy life in our community. And so it means a lot that you're taking the time just to help explain some of these questions that so many of our patients have. So thanks for being here again with me.
Thanks. My pleasure. Happy to be here.
In our last episode, we talked about what to expect in a C-section, just kind of being able to explain to people what they can expect on the day of. And I thought today we could dive into something somewhat similar, in hysterectomy. And I know that a lot of people don't associate physiotherapy with hysterectomy. It sounds like a very separate thing, but a lot of the people that I see are having or have had a hysterectomy. And so it's all absolutely related. And I'd love to share at the end a little bit about what people could expect from a physio, what we do have to offer for clients like this. But before we get going, I want you to share a little bit for the listeners, a little bit about yourself, you know, where you are, who you are, and then we'll jump into the details around hysterectomy.
Sure. So I'm Kate Collins, and I'm a general obstetrician gynecologist in Kelowna, BC. So I practice out of Kelowna General Hospital, and I guess that's pretty much it.
There's so much more to you, Kate, but that's...
I know, it's that's, true.
That's what people know you as, right? So let's talk a little bit about like what is actually a hysterectomy to start with. You know, what is it? I know there's different types, so start there, you know.
Yeah, so a hysterectomy specifically refers to removing the body of the uterus and the cervix. So it doesn't include removing the ovaries. It doesn't include removing the fallopian tubes. I will say the vast majority of the time now when we're doing hysterectomies, we are taking out the fallopian tubes at the same time, and we call that a salpingectomy. And that's because we think that a lot of what we have traditionally thought of as ovarian cancers actually start in the fallopian tubes. So we're doing it as a risk reducing procedure since we're already doing surgery. But then we would call that a hysterectomy and salpingectomy. So hysterectomy itself solely relates to the uterus, which I think is sometimes confusing for patients, because I think in the general population, people will often use hysterectomy to include taking out other organs as well, but technically that is not the case.
And then if they have their ovaries or one removed, we call oophorectomy?
We call that an oophorectomy.
And so what about, you know, can you talk a little bit about why this might be indicated? Because we talked briefly before we hit record that I had noticed a trend that less hysterectomies are being done overall, but, you know, still obviously done sometimes. So can you talk a little bit about why hysterectomy might be indicated for your clients?
Absolutely. So, there's a number of different reasons for hysterectomy. One of the most common ones would be overly heavy periods, typically that haven't responded to medical management. And so that's where one of the areas where we see, I think, a decrease in the rate of hysterectomy is that historically we didn't have good medical management, but now we do. We have a number of much less invasive options that women can use and then potentially avoid the major abdominal surgery. But that doesn't always work. And so sometimes they end up with a hysterectomy. And then another reason would be if you have an overly enlarged uterus, which typically is due to fibroids, which are a benign tumor of the uterus. Because if the uterus actually gets so big that it's causing symptoms related to that, like pressure or urinary frequency, or basically feeling like you're pregnant, because your uterus is in fact the size of a 5-month pregnancy or 6-month pregnancy, then often hysterectomy is indicated. We also will sometimes do hysterectomy for painful periods, again, if medical management hasn't been effective. And again, we have much better medical management than we did, say, 20, 30 years ago. And then we also do hysterectomy in the context of precancers and cancers of the uterus and cervix sometimes as well. Or it's also included typically in surgery for ovarian cancer.
So you mentioned
also we often do hysterectomies in conjunction with procedures for pelvic organ prolapse. So hysterectomy itself doesn't actually treat any pelvic organ prolapse.
Yes, I think that is definitely a big misconception, because that's what a lot of the clients I notice say, or sometimes I've asked them, what to the best of your understanding, why did you have a hysterectomy? I don't know. It's funny how many people say, I don't know. Or I think, like you said, though, that a lot of them had their hysterectomy years and years and years ago, when sometimes it was, I'm not sure what's going on, or our only option is to surgically remove. Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned some other symptoms that people might have. And I think that's why often they present to someone like myself. So quite often they might be having some urinary urgency, feelings of pressure, something doesn't feel right, pain. Yes, stress incontinence, a whole host of things. Is there anything else you can think of that, well, you said bleeding, anything else you can think of that people can currently describe?
Well, I think urinary urgency would be the other one.
When they
have a big, like, frequency and they have an enlarged uterus, certainly can present a lot like overactive bladder. But
then
if you remove the uterus, it in fact often resolves entirely.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the other medical
I guess would be the other one.
Which one, sorry?
Bloating if you have a really big uterus.
Yes. What are some of the other medical management options that you mentioned that some people, that maybe they've heard from their friends, oh, these symptoms, you probably need a hysterectomy. I'm just picturing some of the people listening to this.
Yeah.
And they've maybe heard from their friends, I think you need a hysterectomy. What are some of the things that the medical management options that you might discuss with these patients before you start thinking about surgical options?
Certainly. So, for bleeding, we often use, there are pills that you can take 4 times a day on the days of heavy bleeding that can decrease your bleeding. Regular anti-inflammatories can also decrease your bleeding during menses. We use the birth control to decrease bleeding. We use, there are hormonal IUDs we use a lot of to decrease bleeding. And then there's also, if you're an appropriate candidate, which is typically done childbearing and over 40, and then potentially a day surgery called an ablation where the lining of the uterus is burned, is also a potential option for bleeding. For painful periods, we also use a lot of the birth control pill. We use a lot of, the progesterone IUDs. And then there's also some progesterone pills we use, and then another medication called GnRH agonist that we use a fair amount as well. So we do now have sort of a number of arrows in our holster to manage things before we get to hysterectomy, whereas historically those weren't necessarily available. And then in the context of like an enlarged uterus, there is also sometimes an option to do an interventional radiology procedure called a uterine fibroid embolization that can shrink the uterus sometimes adequately to control those, what we call bulk-related symptoms or symptoms related to an enlarged uterus. And then in terms of pelvic organ prolapse, it's less medication. It's more pelvic floor physiotherapy and Kegel exercises. And then also we have the option of using supportive measures such as a pessary, which is a device that goes into the vagina and sort of helps to support things before we move to a surgical option.
So obviously, like if it was someone, let's say if it was myself that was having symptoms, and I was probably referred to you from my family doctor, and I would come in and we would talk about my symptoms and how bothersome they are, and then you'd present options. And I can just picture there's some people that probably would rather have surgical intervention than medication, right? And so I guess, well, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you probably present the options. And then people still at the end of the day kind of have a say in where they want to start. And I'm sure a lot of it, you look at it as trial and error, like, would you like to try this? And then let's see what your symptoms do. But then there's other options. It's never just one thing.
Absolutely. And we usually start to, there's usually a period of investigation. Like often if you have, say, if you're having heavy periods, there's blood work and we need to do imaging. Sometimes we need to get a biopsy from the lining of the uterus before we can sort of proceed to even consider management options. Because we want to make sure we're not missing something. Like say, if you have really heavy periods, but it turns out you actually have a really low functioning thyroid, that could actually be the cause. And then in fact, it's far more important to treat your thyroid, which may fix your periods, than to jump, say, to surgery.
So in the event that you decide that surgery is the best option for the person in front of you, can you talk a little bit about the surgical procedures? Because from what I understand, you can go in through an abdominal incision, vaginally, laparoscopic. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, why you might choose one over the other and the differences?
Yeah, absolutely. So we tend to try to do a hysterectomy through a minimally invasive approach, if possible. And a minimally invasive approach includes both a laparoscopic hysterectomy and a vaginal hysterectomy. And so for a vaginal hysterectomy, all of the surgery is done through the vagina. So the only incision that you have on sort of the outside of your body is at the top of the vagina. And then all of the ligaments and blood supply to the uterus are obviously cut and tied and secured. For a laparoscopic approach, we put a little about half centimeter incision at your belly button and put a camera through the belly button and inflate your abdomen with carbon dioxide. And then there's typically three more half centimeter incisions in your abdomen to allow us to do the surgery. And we use these long, small instruments and the camera to basically do the surgery. And the benefit to that is that typically hospital stay is shorter. Recovery is still 6 weeks, but it's usually much better. And there's less blood loss and lower infection rates with those. Typically, in terms of when we're trying to decide between those two, it includes, you know, the indication for surgery, like whether we're removing ovaries at the same time or not, as well as if you've had vaginal deliveries before, if you've had surgeries in your belly before, and how big your uterus is. And then in terms of when we make more of an abdominal incision, typically, I would say it's partly surgeon expertise and surgeon preference, but I would say the vast majority of the time it's with significantly enlarged uteruses. Because when we're doing a surgery laparoscopically, you still have the incision at the top of the vagina, but we have to be able to get your uterus out through the vagina. So if the uterus is, in fact, you know, up at your belly button, it can be really challenging to get a uterus that is, you know, this big out of the vagina. And some of the other reasons that we would end up doing surgery through like a abdominal incision would be if there's a lot of scar tissue inside your abdomen that we can't safely do the surgery laparoscopically. And then rarely if you have a medical condition that would mean you can't tolerate laparoscopy, because to do the surgery laparoscopically, there's higher ventilation pressure. So meaning it's harder for the anesthesiologist to help you continue to breathe throughout the surgery, because we've now put all this pressure into your abdomen because of the carbon dioxide. And we also have to tilt your head down to do the surgery. And that allows your bowels to sort of move out of the way so that we can safely do the surgery. And if we can't position you well enough to do that, then we may have to do an abdominal incision. And then the abdominal incision that we do, it's typically what we call a fan and steel incision, or it's a like a C-section type cut. So a horizontal cut sort of at the level of the pubic hair. Very rarely, at least for benign gynecology surgery, you could end up with an up and down, what we call like a vertical midline incision, or an up and down incision in the middle of your abdomen. That would be much more common for gynecology oncologists to do, which is not something I do.
So I imagine there's times where, you know, you get consent from people. I mean, you go in thinking you're going to go through a certain avenue, but then something changes, right? And that might happen, that you think you're going to do this vaginally or laparoscopically because they're under general anesthetic regardless, correct?
Yes, right? Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and then
a vaginal hysterectomy can actually be done under spinal. But almost always they're under general anesthetic.
And so sometimes there might be times where you have to kind of change the procedure, and that's explained to them, I'm sure, before.
Absolutely. It's certainly it's a risk of any of the minimally invasive approaches that we might have to convert to an abdominal procedure if we can't safely do the surgery, or if we get into a complication that we can't safely manage laparoscopically or vaginally.
And I think one of the things I take away from that explanation is I think people are always looking for black and white, like, oh, my friend had this, but you're such an individual, and you're going to have that discussion with your surgeon. You can't watch, no YouTube video you watch is going to tell you which type of, incision or which type of procedure they're going to do, because you're unique and your symptoms are unique and your body's unique, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So no amount of Googling is going to give you that answer. Yeah.
No, unfortunately not. And even often we don't know, like, there are certainly times where we think someone will be an excellent candidate for one of the minimally invasive approaches. And we look in, say it's laparoscopically, we look in with the camera and there is just a lot of scar tissue that was completely unexpected and we're not able to do it safely laparoscopically. It's rare, but it does happen.
I'm curious to know. I don't want to compare apples to oranges. And I mean, people after a C-section are going home with a baby, which is a whole different element of, recovery considerations. But overall, how would you kind of compare the two? Meaning, like, is there one that's quote unquote harder on the tissues, or you think this is going to be a more difficult recovery, a C-section versus a
hysterectomy? I find people have more trouble recovering from a hysterectomy than a C-section.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's probably a combination of things, like in terms of the surgery itself, like how much surgery is being done inside your abdomen. Certainly from an abdominal hysterectomy than a C-section, I would say. And the age at which you tend to have a hysterectomy versus a C-section, and people's expectations as well. You don't have a baby that you're having to take care of. So I think sometimes women after C-sections end up feeling like they need to be superwomen. But I will say overall, I think people who have had both tell me, because I've only had C-sections, I have not had a hysterectomy, but tell me that they feel that the recovery after hysterectomy was harder.
That's interesting, because I do think, we can't say everyone's going to think that or experience that, but I do think people go in thinking it's a seemingly small procedure. I think that's the sentiment.
And I think that with the minimally invasive approaches, which I think are wonderful and do make the recovery probably better, like way better, but because you wake up and you either have no incisions on your abdomen or just these little tiny like poke holes, people feel like they should be able to jump back up and start doing things. And certainly I think recovery from some other laparoscopic procedures that are commonly done, like a appendectomy or a cholecyst, a gallbladder removal, it's not quite as much surgery being done inside your abdomen. So I think people underestimate how much cutting and burning is being done inside their abdomen when we're removing a hysterectomy and that. And so then I think sometimes, I could be wrong, but I feel like people have this expectation that they're going to be able to get up and do so much. And some people are. Some people feel wonderful after a couple of weeks, but not everyone does. And I think it's very normal if that's the case.
Well, and I talk about this with people after having a birth too, and the importance of rest. But I think, I mean, if my husband came out of the hospital with crutches and a knee brace or like a Gen 2 brace, like that's a very obvious injury. And he would not have any shame in explaining that his knee had a surgery and that like why he needs help. Whereas I find most women, like as soon as they say I had to have a procedure and they're hush hush, I kind of think, I bet you she had a hysterectomy, but we don't talk about this. Like there's something about that that's embarrassing or taboo. And I think a lot of women don't share. So it's like this invisible thing that you can't really explain to people. No one asks questions. Yeah. I think it sounds like a big thing. And we were talking again before we hit record, how psychologically hard this can be just with the end of a chapter for a lot of women, that even though maybe they had no desire to conceive or they're quite happy to not conceive again, your reproductive organ, major reproductive organ is being removed, right? So there's a lot of stuff tied into that.
Absolutely.
I'm curious to know then, overall, which post-op instructions are people sent home with? So generally, how long can they expect they're in the hospital? And then what will they go home with?
So for a minimally invasive approach, like a vaginal hysterectomy or a laparoscopic hysterectomy, I would say they go home usually the next day, sometimes the same day, depending on how the procedure went and what time of day the procedure happened and the surgeon and the patient and how they're doing. If you have to have an abdominal hysterectomy and you have like a bigger incision, then usually you're in the hospital for 2 nights and then go home. Although again, if you're doing really well, then it's not impossible you'd go home more around the 36 hour mark. And then in terms of recovery, regardless of the approach of C-section that you had, there's still no heavy lifting. So typically, ideally, nothing more than 10, maybe 15 pounds for 6 weeks, and pelvic rest. So nothing in the vagina for 6 weeks, but really until your surgeon says it's okay. And that's because even for the minimally invasive approaches, the biggest incision you have is at the top of the vagina. So you want to make sure that that's well healed before we start heavy lifting, before we start resuming intercourse or going off pelvic rest. And that can take a little bit longer sometimes to heal than 6 weeks. And that's why it's important to make sure that you're seeing your surgeon and that they give you the okay to resume those activities before you do.
So you would follow up with them. They'd come to your office. How many times roughly within that first 6 weeks?
It depends on the patient. I won't lie. A lot of the times, if it's a completely uncomplicated procedure, then often I don't see them until 6 weeks unless they have a concern. But if it is a more complicated procedure, then often I'd see them sooner. And if they have an abdominal incision and are getting staples removed, then often they would come to see their surgeon for that here. But lots of places I've worked with, that's not the case. That would be done by home care or a family physician. So it's not universal.
And then you would be doing a vaginal exam before you'd kind of quote unquote discharge them.
Exactly.
Or approve intercourse or.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yep. Okay.
That's certainly typically part of that 6 week visit. And I would say it's really important if you have any concerns before then to contact your surgeon's office, because we always want to know about it and we would very happily see you sooner if need be. It's not like you can't be seen for 6 weeks, but if you have no concerns and feel like you're healing well, you don't really need to come and see us before then.
What can people expect for vaginal bleeding after that?
So it's variable. It's typically fairly light. I generally tell people that it's normal to have light bleeding or spotting, and it can be on and off. It can go, sometimes you don't have any, but sometimes it will go on and off, and really up until the point in time where your surgeon tells you you're all healed, it's pretty normal. But if you're having heavy vaginal bleeding, then that would be a reason to contact your surgeon for sure.
And
period like or heavier, depending on your periods, but I would
want
to know.
What's the spiel or what's the discussion you have with people when they want to know what's going to happen with their cycle? Because obviously if they still have their ovaries, you know, they're still going to cycle. Can you say what you would say to your clients when you have that conversation with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So it doesn't actually change. It doesn't change your hormones. It doesn't change your cycle. You just stop having an actual period, but any sort of cyclical other symptoms that you get, like premenstrual symptoms, or if you're someone who gets middle smirch, so pain when you ovulate, all of that is still going to continue. And the flip side is, the good thing is, you're not going to suddenly become menopausal unless we remove your ovaries. So as long as we're just doing a hysterectomy, then it doesn't change the rest of your cycle. It just takes away your periods.
Would you say that that kind of shock to the system changes the cycle? Would you kind of expect them to maybe have a funny cycle for a couple months, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, but it wouldn't be unexpected for sure. Certainly with any surgery, it wouldn't be unexpected to and have so, a change.
Yeah. So you'd kind of expect that, you're going to still cycle. You just won't have the bleed. Mm-hmm. Exactly. What about, so then the term surgical menopause is when you do kind of do that oophorectomy, you remove the ovaries or maybe you remove one. What, you know, that person might cycle sometimes. What can you talk a little bit about, you know,
so if we remove one, it shouldn't impact your cycles. Because you actually only need about, like, you don't need both ovaries to continue cycling normally. But if we remove both, then certainly you will be in surgical menopause, and it largely depends on the age at which we do that. If you were someone who was already perimenopausal, you were already getting hot flashes and night sweats. It might not actually change your symptoms a ton, but they do often get a little bit worse. But if you are someone who is 30 and has to have your ovaries out and you were cycling completely regularly, had no change in your ovarian function, it can be quite intense quite quickly. Like before you leave the hospital, you get hot flashes and night sweats.
Wow. And so that's a discussion probably on an individual level too, about what you're going to do about hormone therapy.
Absolutely. And it's a bit more complicated because, you know, the reasons, it's uncommon for us to remove the ovaries in a premenopausal patient without good reason. And many of the reasons that we'd be doing that have significant implications for hormone therapy. Like if you have a cancer, although they tend to be in postmenopausal women, but if you have a uterine cancer, then sometimes you can't take hormone therapy afterwards. Mm-hmm. But absolutely it is something that gets discussed if we're taking out ovaries in a premenopausal woman.
So, and then what can they expect for pain management? So what would people expect to be taking and for roughly how long?
Yeah. So it's typically you'd be taking an anti-inflammatory and Tylenol regularly. So an anti-inflammatory like Advil or diclofenac or naproxen. And then often you will have a narcotic of some kind to take as needed. Like often I personally use Tramacet a lot. So you take either plain Tylenol or Tramacet, which has Tylenol and something called Tramadol in it. But it really depends on the patient. And I will say the minimally invasive hysterectomies, often people don't need narcotics. They're often okay with anti-inflammatories and Tylenol, but then some people do need them and that's okay. That's also normal if you do need that after a minimally invasive hysterectomy. It's far more common to need the narcotics after an abdominal incision hysterectomy. And then in terms of how long, I would say, again, it's highly variable, but it would probably be pretty common to be taking stuff for at least a week and then weaning off from there. But, you know, I've had patients after minimally invasive surgeries who didn't take anything after leaving the hospital. And I've had patients who had to have, you know, anti-inflammatories and narcotics for a couple of weeks. And it just depends on the patient.
So I'm guessing based on the fact that, you know, they need to be sent home with some pain management, plus the level of extent of the surgery, plus the lack of mobility, like you do not want these people to be constipated.
No.
So are they getting a stool softener in the hospital, or and do you send them home saying, please take a stool softener? Or what's the conversation around that?
So I usually do, particularly if they're using narcotics, I do talk about a stool softener with them and usually prescribe one in the hospital, especially for an abdominal hysterectomy, because the minimally invasive ones, they're often not in the hospital long enough where it would really make a difference, but certainly we talk about it. And it often depends too on what other surgeries we were doing. Like say if it was a pelvic organ prolapse surgery simultaneously, then we're a bit more aggressive in managing constipation, but certainly you want to minimize constipation mm-hmm. for sure, because that straining can be really painful.
Mm-hmm. And a question that I get is, you know, bathing and swimming after, not that they're asking me for the advice, but mm-hmm. sometimes it comes up with return to activity and when can I do certain things. So that's when swimming might come up. What do you say about that?
It's typically the 6 weeks until the top of the vagina is healed.
For bathing as well?
Yeah, for baths. Yeah.
Yeah.
With the exception of sometimes there are certain situations with prolapse surgeries where we may use sitz baths, but otherwise we tend to avoid them.
Gotcha.
To minimize the infection risk.
What would you say then? What are the routine complications you're talking to people about? I'm sure infection's one of them you've mentioned. And just absolutely. The reason you put in things like the no swimming and the no heavy lifting are because you want to protect the area, allow the tissues to shorten and become stronger. But overall, what are some of the maybe the complications that if you expect to see, you know, some of the ones that you would see more than others?
Mm-hmm. So infection, and that can be either ones that are pretty minor would be more common, and that would be things like infections at your skin incisions or at the top of the vagina, or a bladder infection because you have a catheter during the surgery. And then far more rarely, you could get a more significant infection inside your abdomen that could require hospitalization. It could require IV antibiotics and repeat procedures, but that is pretty uncommon, but certainly they happen. With any surgery, there's always the risk of anesthetic, which can include, sadly, can include catastrophic things like stroke and heart attack and death, but that is thankfully exceedingly rare. There is the risk of injuring other things inside your abdomen around where we're working. So certainly we're as careful as we possibly can be, but there is always a risk of injury to the other structures in your abdomen. And that's things like the bowel, the bladder, the ureters, which are the tubes that bring pee from the kidneys down to the bladder. And again, as long as those are seen at the time of surgery, they are fixed then. But very rarely they're not seen, in which case you would get symptoms later. And again, it would be dealt with, but it can require repeat surgeries and repeat procedures. And then there's also a risk with any surgery of deep vein thrombosis or blood clots in your legs. And it's related to not moving and prolonged immobility. And so often you will get shots of a blood thinner while you're in the hospital to help prevent that. And then we want you moving as much as you're comfortable with. Once you go home, we do typically also use some inflatable, deflatable stockings to sort of massage your legs during the surgery and until you're moving after the surgery. Those are the big ones that we always talk about beforehand. And if you're having a minimally invasive approach, we always talk about the fact that there may be a need to convert to an abdominal approach.
And one other thing I wanted to ask you about, and I asked you about it in the last episode we did about C-section, is the use of compression. And this is something that I've really started thinking about, honestly, since I had my own abdominal surgery about 2 years ago, and used compression a lot after, and thought, wow, like it really made a difference. And it made me think of how maybe we don't use it enough for people with similar procedures. And so I'm curious to know, there's different garments out there, but very similar to how people often have an abdominal binder after a hernia repair. I wonder your thoughts on, you know, there's so many different products on the market, but that essentially through, you know, something that looks like spandex shorts or kind of a band that people can wear. And the evidence shows that they can be helpful for just ease of movement, less pain, less fear with moving. And I always think, well, that sounds great. So I often present it to my clients as an option and say, look into this. This is an option. And sometimes I default to ask your surgeon because people feel more comfortable when they ask you, which I totally understand. And sometimes I read things like, don't have anything over the incision, which makes me nervous to recommend compression to someone when I would never want to go against what their surgeon says. But I guess I just want you to speak on that a little bit again, too. I see it as it can be a huge asset, but is there any times that you wouldn't want someone to use something like that post-surgery?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think it could be a really potentially really good asset. And I know we had talked about it last time with C-section. And as a result, I'm aware now of some of the evidence in terms of improved pain control after C-section. And I think that there's certainly a good possibility it could be very beneficial in hysterectomy as well, but particularly the abdominal hysterectomy. Although, you know, if someone wanted to try it after a laparoscopic or vaginal surgery, I don't think there would be any real downside to it beyond having the investment in the garment. Overall, I think there's very few situations where I wouldn't really want it being used. I would think only if your incision was actively infected and open and draining things, I think then it's probably not good. But otherwise, I think the risk is pretty low, and I think the benefit is quite possibly very high. So
yeah, exactly. Something to consider. And when in doubt, ask your surgeon. A lot of people will be listening to this beforehand. So yeah, have a conversation with them, because I think whatever makes you feel more comfortable is the most important thing. I wonder if, so again, I wanted to touch on the fact that most people do not associate physiotherapy with hysterectomy. And I just wanted to, if it's okay, a lot of this you'll know, but for the sake of others, and maybe there's some things, just like when I listen to you, I learn a lot. Just to let you know some of the things that maybe bring people in to see a physio and what exactly we would be doing. So I listened to you talk about some of the concurrent symptoms, and I think that's why someone would show up to us in the first place. And maybe they either know a hysterectomy is on their horizon, or they've, you know, they've got some of these symptoms of heaviness, pressure, heavy bleeding, but they probably come to us because of more like stress incontinence, frequency, pain with intercourse, and someone has sent them to see us and they think they're seeing you for the bleeding and us for the incontinence when it's kind of like tied into the same thing. So I would say overall, one of the things I would do is I would just help them understand their body. I always say the pelvic floor is a muscle we don't normally think about. So can I give you some information, help you understand what it feels like to let go of those muscles, tense those muscles? Quite often, because people have irritating symptoms, they hold a lot of tension, whether they know it or not. Maybe the pressure makes them hold a lot of tension. Maybe because they're nervous, because they might pee their pants, they are holding more tension. But then the pelvic floor quite often just has more tone than what is quote unquote normal. So just kind of having some education about what does it feel like to have control of those muscles? What does it feel like to let out a pee and a poo on the toilet? What does it feel like to hold in a pee and a poo? How are these muscles related to pee, poop, and sex? And I think too, you know, like you said, the symptoms of bloating, the symptoms of bleeding, they often just create a lot of fear and the unknown. They might start avoiding certain activities. So they feel deconditioned, right? And they're wanting to know, you know, how to get back to exercise or what things to consider, things like that. I also think too, you know, the pelvic floor can have coordination issues. So sometimes maybe if they're, I see a lot of times that sometimes people describe it to them, your anal muscles are bossy. So they might have a lot of tension in and around the back of their pelvic floor, whereas kind of a slowness at the front of the pelvic floor. And so again, everybody's unique. I can't say I would do the same thing with everybody, but these are some of the things that we might see. I also think too that building a rapport, because I think that this is something you're talking about, embarrassing symptoms you're not used to talking about with anyone. And then on the other side of a hysterectomy, I think people feel very vulnerable and scared to reach out to a new person. And so just building that rapport ahead of time and letting them know what I can help with. I usually say, you know, help them ask your surgeon these questions. And I think that this interview with you helps me understand what you're talking about with them. And then I might have some questions for you as well, as far as what this person can do. Sure. But I often tell the people, like, let's say they say, I'm going to have a hysterectomy with Dr. Collins on January 30th. I might say, you know what, reach out to me. I don't know what your questions are going to be. I don't know how you're going to feel, but let's make an online appointment after, because then you don't have to leave your house. We can get onto a call like this and you can tell me are you having a hard time getting up? Do you feel like you're having pain? Are you like, maybe then I'm suggesting compression to them. Maybe they feel really nervous about holding in their pee. They're having a hard time holding in gas. Maybe they feel like $1 million and they don't know what they can or cannot be doing. So I might kind of go through with them, you know, this is within your surgeon's guidelines, but you can get up like this, or let's troubleshoot a way for you to get up without pain. So, you know, quite often it's just, I always think of us as physios as the now what people, similar to after an ortho surgery, when the ortho, all you get are guidelines saying non-weight bearing 6 weeks. Well, then I'll help you fill in the blanks. Like, how are you going to get up and down the stairs? How are you going to get in and out of your bed? How are you going to maneuver with those crutches? What can you do with your leg? Because just because you're non-weight bearing doesn't mean you can't move it. So it's honestly, I think, a parallel to when the ortho surgeon says non-weight bearing, but we know, like in other areas of the body, like surgeons, they just have that, go see the physio, and then we know what our role is. And I think in the women's health world, that's still kind of missing. It's like, you know, we don't just give Kegels, but more just like, okay, this is what Dr. Collins said. Let me help you fill in the blanks now, as far as what types of activity you can do, not only with your pelvic floor, but with your whole body, because those are some of the things that we would look at. And then for an example, I had a gal the other day that said, I'm over 6 weeks post-op now. The recovery's been a bit longer than I thought. I want to move my body, and I have permission to move my body from my surgeon, but I am scared. I am going to do damage. I am totally nervous. I like to lift heavy weights, and technically I have the clearance, but I'm terrified. And so for those people, we would help them just like after the knee, like, sure, you have your weight bearing guidelines now, but let's work up to soccer. Let's work up to running. Let's just give you some guidance for progressive rehab, because I think sometimes it's hard for people to see between the black and white, right? It's like, I'm allowed to, and some people will feel comfortable progressing themselves. Other people don't. And I think, again, same thing over and over that we keep saying, it's an individual thing. And some people feel very comfortable just guiding themselves, and that's okay. Other people like more guidance. And so that's kind of our role as physios, is help fill in some of the blanks, help you fill in some of the practical things, and get you back to some of the goals that you have. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I think it can be hugely helpful. And I do try to remember to warn people that, yes, it's 6 weeks until you're allowed to start doing more things, but that you're not going to be like, oh, I'm right back to where I was before, typically, because you're now deconditioned, because you haven't been able to do things, and you may still have some discomfort, and so you have to progress slowly. But I think that physio can be super helpful, because we don't, as surgeons, don't typically actually have any expertise beyond saying that, like, you do this, but we don't actually know how to help you really itemize that into an action plan, I think.
And if that's normal. We can't all know everything. And that's when, as soon as I kind of equate that to, like, I honestly think that a lot of what the ortho surgeons learn is then you refer to physio. They don't necessarily learn what we do. It's kind of just like, and I think it's just a little bit more, nobody says, like, my surgeon didn't give me exercises. Nobody says that about their ortho surgeon. Yeah. Whereas I do think a lot of it falls onto you guys unfairly. There's a few things. One, there's physio built into the healthcare system after the orthopedic surgeries. We don't have that in the women's health world right now. There's no physios in public practice. So people do kind of have to seek out their own help in the private world. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of free information like this that people can take in to just, you know, fill in some of those blanks. Okay. Anything else that you feel, if you picture the patients that are always sitting in your office, you're having the conversations about hysterectomy with them, anything else that you feel you would want in this conversation for them to hear?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's a conversation you have individually with your surgeon. And, you know, with some of the, if you want to find a physio in your area, then find someone that has the right feel for you. But yeah, I really appreciate you taking this time and helping explain this, because I have not only learned some things, but I know other people listening will learn a lot too. And that's a wrap. If you enjoyed the show, can I ask you a big favor? Would you do one of three things for me? Number one, leave a review, because we could all use a little positive feedback sometimes. Number two, download the episodes, because it helps me see what people are interested in. Or number three, share it with somebody else, because sharing is caring. Catch you next time.